I'll be right up front with you this morning. This chapter ends with a cliffhanger. You know, one of those moments where the hero of the story and their friends are in danger. They're hanging from the cliff and you don't know what's going to happen to them. Tune in next time to find out. That's this chapter. Because we are slowing down and studying this story instead of just retelling it, at times we will have to leave things unresolved along the way. In fact, the last word of this chapter in the NIV is bewildered. The King James has it as perplexed. Many other translations say in confusion. We're only going to get to the part of this story where nearly everybody is agitated, perplexed, confused, and bewildered. Have you been there? Are you living there right now? Bewildered. What a terrible feeling that is. You don't understand what's going on. Not only are you not in control of your own story, you know you're not in control of your own story, right? Well, not only are you not in control of your own story, you don't understand the story that you're living in. You can't comprehend what's going on in the story in which you're living. It's painful and scary and disorienting. You're bewildered. In chapter 3 of this story, which has been filled with twists and turns so far, takes another turn. And this time it's a downturn. There have been little hints of a grave danger looming over this story in the first two chapters, and now the true threat is revealed and made real. Chapter 3 tells the story of an existential crisis for the people of God. A crisis, a plot, a conspiracy that affected and endangered all of the Jews. And even potentially endangered our salvation. Your salvation and mine are on the line in this story. And it all swirled around a character that we have not yet met in this tale. A villain named Haman. Esther does not show up in chapter 3. We'll have to wait for next week to see her again. But this enemy does. His name is Haman, and he's called in verse 10, the enemy of the Jews. When Jews have retold this story throughout the years, they've taken great delight in making a monstrous racket every time Haman's name is mentioned in this story. Did you know that? They will put on a play that reenacts the story of Esther. And when Haman is mentioned, the kids in the audience especially will set off noisemakers, like rattles and stuff like that, right? I once watched a play like this, and every time Haman was named, we all in the crowd went, boo, hiss, right? Like an old-time melodrama where the bad guy has a curly mustache and rubs his hands together all the time. Now, we're not going to do that every time that Haman is mentioned in the next several weeks, but we got to do it at least once a week, right? So the first time that I read his name, we're going to go, boo, hiss, to remember this man was an enemy and to drown out his name. Should we practice? Yeah, let's practice, all right? All right, here, 3, 2, 1, I'll say Haman, but you make it so that we can't hear his name, all right? Ready? 3, 2, 1, Haman. Yeah, yeah. All right, some of you go boo and some of you go hiss, all right? Let's try it one more time. 3, 2, 1, Haman. You got it. There have been a lot of twists and turns to get to this point in the story. It all started at a royal banquet in the citadel of Susa, where King Xerxes was drinking it up with all of his buddies and foolishly demanded his queen, Vashti, appear before them to show herself off. She refused. And Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus, allowed himself to be talked into banishing her and looking for a replacement queen. That was chapter 1. Xerxes did this search cruelly by taking pretty girls from all over his kingdom and subjecting them to a beauty and sex contest. The losers get life in the harem. The winner becomes a queen. This was not a great kingdom for women. But, plot twist, the lovely woman who won the contest and the favor of everyone turned out to be a beautiful orphan girl whose family was in exile from Israel. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, and her Persian name was Esther, the star queen. We know that she's a Jew, but nobody else does. Her cousin Mordecai had been raising her and told her to keep her Jewish identity secret. He was apparently doing the same as he worked as a lowly civil servant at the king's gate, probably doing some kind of administration. At the very end of chapter 2, we learned that Mordecai, in that position, just so happened to hear that two of the king's security guards had gotten angry and planned to assassinate the king. And Mordecai had told Esther, and Queen Esther had told the king, and the two security guards were left impaled in the front yard as a warning for all to see. And do you remember how Mordecai was rewarded for this in chapter 2? Crickets, right? Plot twist, Mordecai was not rewarded for this. They wrote it down, and then nothing happened, which was really weird in Persian culture. And you know what? If that had happened to me, you know how I would feel? Bewildered. I mean, why did that happen? My cousin is the queen? I stopped a plot against the King of Kings in our era, and all I got was this lousy t-shirt? My name got written down in a book? Thanks a lot. And it's worse than that. Somebody else did get a promotion. Let's look at the very next thing. Let's read verse 1 of chapter 3 again. And get ready, because here it comes, to boo and hiss, just the first time we see his name. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. What? Not only is Mordecai not promoted, but this guy is? And it's not even Memucan or any of the other seven dummies from the Council of Advisors in chapter 1. We don't even know if this guy was around back then, but all of a sudden here he is, and he's the top guy? Verse 2. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman. Just the first time. For the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Huh. The plot thickens. The king had commanded that everybody bow down before Haman. That's interesting, because it's what was normal in that culture anyway. This is what you do when the authority goes by. Lots of bowing to each other, especially to those who are in authority. But the king felt that he had to tell everybody to do this for Haman. It doesn't say why. Perhaps it was just a formality. He's at the top. We'll put out a little thing saying everybody bow. Or perhaps this was like what he demanded all of the wives do for their husbands in chapter 1. He demanded respect instead of earning it. And he demanded honor for this Haman, whether or not Haman was honorable. Perhaps nobody would have honored Haman if it wasn't the rule. Well, one person decided that he was not going to honor Haman in this way. Our man Mordecai. Why? Well, it doesn't say why. Why do you think? It's not that the Jews refuse to honor those in authority. They will even do this kind of bowing towards each other or those in authority. This is not the same thing as what Nebuchadnezzar wanted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to do in Daniel chapter 3. Some interpreters have assumed that it must have been like that, and that maybe Haman was carrying around an idol in his pocket. Right? So that Mordecai was faced with the same ethical choice about worship, or that Haman was claiming some kind of a divine status, but it doesn't say that here at all. Mordecai just refused to honor Haman. Some have thought that it must be because he was jealous of Haman, and that's why he did it. It was pride. That's possible. It doesn't come out and say that either. I think that at least partially it comes from a very old family feud. Two words make me think that. One is the word Agagite from verse 1 of this chapter, and the other is one I told you last week to tuck into your brain. It's in chapter 2, verse 5. What's the word? Kish. Kish, that's right. Kish was either Mordecai's great-grandfather or his ancestor from even further back, maybe even 500 years. Haman was related to Agag in some way, and Mordecai was related to King Saul in some way, whose dad was named Kish. Now that's a deep cut, right? Do you remember those names from your Old Testament history? Agag and Kish? It's been more than 500 years, but these memories are long. Agag was an Amalekite. The Amalekites were the first nation to attack Israel without mercy when they came up out of Egypt on their way to the Promised Land. You could read about it in Exodus chapter 17. The Lord did not forget what they had done and told Israel to not forget and promised in Deuteronomy chapter 25 that the Amalekites would be judged for it. Fast forward to 1 Samuel chapter 15. And King Saul, whose dad's name was Kish, was sent to bring that judgment on the Amalekites and their king, whose name was Agag. And Saul, being partially obedient, what's our word for partially obedient? Disobedient, did not execute King Agag as he was supposed to. And at that moment, Saul lost the kingdom, which then went to King David. So these two families have some unsettled business. Both have found their way far away from the boundaries of Israel, and they are locked into their conflict hundreds of miles away in the Persian citadel of Susa. I think that's at least part of why Mordecai won't bow. Maybe it's all these things together. Not just because of a basic family feud, it's not just the Hatfields and the McCoys, but because the Agagites have been trained through years and years of enmity passed down from generation to generation to hate all of the Jews and want to see them wiped off the planet. It's not just jealousy that someone is Grand Vizier and Mordecai is not. It's that Haman is Grand Vizier and he doesn't deserve honor and must in fact be dishonored. At least I think that's what might be going on in Mordecai's mind. The narrator doesn't come out and say. All it says here is Mordecai would not kneel and pay him honor. This bewildered Mordecai's co-workers. They tried to get him to go along with the crowd. Look at verse 4. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. Ooh. The plot thickens. This plot is getting really thick. It's now out. Mordecai has outed himself as a Jew. When his co-workers couldn't convince him to comply, they ran to Haman to get him into trouble. What a great workplace, right? They wanted to know if they had to really do all this bowing to Haman as well. And if anything was going to happen to Mordecai because he had told them he was a Jew, maybe they could get his spot on the team. It's no longer a secret. Mordecai has decided that now is the time for him to go public with his true identity, and that must have taken courage. Because now the gloves come off. Now the danger really begins. Haman suddenly becomes aware of Mordecai. Look at verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. I don't know how he'd missed it. Perhaps he was so full of himself that he wasn't looking at who didn't bow. He was just assuming every time he went by that everybody bowed. He was so high and mighty he didn't even look down at those peasants to see if they were bowing or not. But now you point him out to me. I can't miss it. Every time I see that Mordecai, he just stands there when I go by. It's also possible that Haman knew that Mordecai was doing this. But he was hoping that Mordecai would get into line without him having to actually do anything about it. He was cowardly like that. But once it was pointed out to him, Haman had to do something. And it wasn't go to Mordecai and confront him and work this out. It was punish him. We're going to punish Mordecai. And you know what? Punishing just Mordecai, only Mordecai, that's not going to be enough. Verse 6. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Where is God? Where is God when you are not recognized for your hard work? Where is God when you're overlooked for a promotion? Where is God when your enemy gets the promotion you deserve? Where is God when someone is out to get you and those you love? I'm sure that Mordecai was feeling that question. What is God doing in this chapter? He's not been named. Did you hear Copper read his name? He's not been named. He's never named in this entire tale. Is he there at all? Because Haman is fixing to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews. And up to this point, they were not just Mordecai's people. They were God's people. Where is God? Do you feel how personal this is? The evil in chapter 1 and the evil in chapter 2 was more general evil and foolishness. That kind of evil hurts people as well. Selfish rulers and their foolish choices can bring a lot of pain to the people around them. Just ask the families of all those pretty girls who were in Xerxes' contest. But this is a lot more personal. This is not just foolishness. This is hate. And it's hate on a grand scale. Haman wants to, verse 6, destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. What's included in that? It stretches from Pakistan to northern Sudan, right? From India to Ethiopia. And what little nation is in the middle of that, in that mix? Israel itself. Haman is going to come up with a plan and the power to exterminate all of the Jews, even the ones in Israel. Look at verse 7. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and month, and the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. I'll stop there for a second. Do you get the picture of what's going on there? This is the 12th year that Xerxes is king. That would probably make it 474 BC. How long has Esther been the queen at this point? Did anybody do the math? Kurt, did you do the math? As soon as I said a number, Kurt started shaking his head. He's my numbers guy. Crunch the numbers. Anybody got it now? 5 years. That's right. Has Haman been angry at Mordecai for 5 years? Has Mordecai been refusing to honor Haman for 5 years? Doesn't say. Maybe all this happened in that 12th year, including Haman's rise to power. But now Haman tries to figure out a good time and day to kill all the Jews. He uses what you and I would consider a randomizer, not his perspective on it. He casts the pur, which is a Persian thing, kind of like a set of dice, which the Persians thought would reveal by divination the most propitious day for some action. Here's some dice that we have at our house. Anybody want to guess what I'm going to get? 7, a 6, and a 1. All right? We play Yahtzee with this one. All right? Now, one pur, right, is like a little clay that has some numbers on it, and you toss this. We don't really know exactly how the system worked, right? Two pur or more is a purim. That's the, or prim. That's the plural. So we don't know the system, but they thought this was magical. Is there anything magical about what's going on in this cup right now? No. Will this tell us what the gods want? What's the most propitious day for killing the Jews? What's a good day for a genocide? They cast the lot, and it fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar, which would have been in the late winter, early spring, March of 473 BC, about 11 months in the future. Interestingly, these months were named by the Jews while they were in captivity. They were just called first, second, and third month in the Torah, but they gave them these proper names when they were in exile. Nisan is the first month. Adar is the 12th month. So there's about 11 months between the two dates. So Haman has his date for this massacre. He thinks it's from the gods. And now he goes for the authority to do it. Verse 8, and boy is he sly. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, there is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from those of all the other people who do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. Do you see what I mean by sly? Haman doesn't mention Mordecai at all, even though all of this is about him. He doesn't mention the grudge. He doesn't talk about Kish and Agag. He doesn't talk about himself at all, except as the man with the plan to rid the king of this pesky problem that he probably hadn't even noticed. And he starts with the truth. There is a certain people dispersed and scattered. True. Among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Also true. Whose customs are different from those of all other people. Also true. They're supposed to be different. They're holy. And who do not obey the king's laws. Perhaps not the ones where the king says you have to honor Haman. But I don't think there are a bunch of other Persian laws that we've seen the Jews disobey. They even went along with the queen contest. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Never mind that Mordecai once saved your life. This is a good reminder to check on people's stories about others. Check your sources. Don't believe every bad report you hear about somebody. Some of that is going to turn out to be gossip and slander, especially if they benefit from the bad story in some way, like a politician with a smear campaign. Haman says that these people contaminate the kingdom and should be exterminated from it. And he's got a plan.
Just leave it to me, he says.
And don't worry about money, O king. Money will not be a problem. I'll make sure this initiative is fully funded. The Greek historian Herodotus said that about this time, the entire income of the Persian king in this year was around, do you want to guess? 15,000 talents of silver. Right? So that's what the king was taking in on a yearly basis around this time. 15,000 talents of silver. Haman promises 10,000 talents of silver. That's 375 tons. It's like 2/3 of the entire kingdom budget for 474 BC. Now, Haman may be exaggerating, but maybe not. Where's he probably planning to get all this money? From all those Jews they were going to kill. That was the plunder. And Xerxes, who keeps losing all these battles to the Greeks, sure needs money to keep up his wars. Follow the money. Verse 10. So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. That's one of the most chilling sentences in the whole Bible. Kind of like Pilate washing his hands. King Ahasuerus gives Haman, the enemy of the Jews, the executive authority to do whatever he wants with all of the Jews. By the way, that phrase that the NIV translates, keep the money, might not mean keep the money. It literally something like, the silver to you. Could be translated something like, well, it's your money, so okay. Or, deal. Use as much of it as you need to affect your plan. And of course, I'll take the rest. How terrible it is that the king didn't even ask Haman the name of the people he was going to exterminate. He's not curious in the slightest. He just delegates the authority to do mass murder. Whatever. He's so careless. There's a negative lesson here about how to wield the authority that we are given in our own domains. Whether we are parents or managers or leaders in church, home, work, or government. This week, if you are a voter, go out and vote for those whom you think will do the best job with the authority that they are granted. Ahasuerus couldn't be bothered to even ask about the details. He just hands over his ring. And Haman takes the ring and runs. Verse 12. Then on the 13th day of the first month, which is probably April 17th, 474 BC, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. Wow, that happened fast. As soon as Haman had the authorization, he put everything in place for the massacre. Just like the Vashti order in chapter 1 and the contest order in chapter 2, this order is translated into every language and sent out as law, binding, irrevocable Persian law to every province in the kingdom. And the instructions on it are very simple. Destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews on March 7th. By order of the king. It's almost a year away. What a terrible thing to anticipate. In 11 months, the Holocaust, the genocide, in one day. And the architect of this evil and the willing dupe behind it sit down for more drinking to celebrate each other. Good job, Grand Vizier. Haman, drink it up. Good job, O King Xerxes. I toast you. We'll show them. But the city of Susa was bewildered. What's going on? What's all this mean? Who all is affected? How are we really going to pay for all this? Does this mean I have to kill my neighbor? Does this mean I get his stuff? Does this mean we're going to die in 11 months? Our whole family, even grandma, even the baby, even Hadassah? Where is God? That's where we're going to stop today. I told you it was going to be a cliffhanger. Mordecai and his people are in danger, and that's where we're going to leave them. In danger. We're going to leave them bewildered, and that's probably helpful for our hearts because that's where we often live as Christians today. Sometimes we're going to be bewildered. We will feel confused and lost and disoriented and perplexed, feeling, if not outright asking the question, where is God? If you haven't had that feeling yet, just wait. It's coming for you. And stories like this in the Bible are helpful for teaching us that we're not necessarily doing something wrong if we feel like that. Where is God when life is unfair? Christians will face this. We live in a broken and unjust world. Where is God when people hate us? Christians will face this, not just Jews. Where is God when we live under a threat? So many Christians around the world face persecution for their beliefs. And though Christians in America have mostly experienced a somewhat privileged status in our national history and almost no violent persecution, that could always change. And there are still plenty who hate us with malice in their hearts. Where is God when evil abounds? Christians will face this question. We have an enemy. The same enemy that Haman was unwittingly working for. So it's probably good that we end on a cliffhanger. Feel the dark clouds of threat and danger that hang over the city of Susa and the kingdom of Persia, especially in Israel. This is real. This is where we live, isn't it? The main application of Esther chapter 3 is that God's people will often have to face injustice and malice, and so we shouldn't be surprised when we're bewildered. The New Testament tells us how followers of Jesus are supposed to actually respond to this. Jesus taught us in the Sermon on the Mount, and Peter taught us in his first letter about loving our enemies and blessing those who persecute us. We've studied both of those things in the last few years. But the key idea here is to just not be surprised when we're bewildered. At the same time, there are also little hints of hope, even in what we just read in chapter 3. And they provide wisdom for us as well. I thought of three points to keep in mind from the little hints of these chapters and in this chapter. And here's number one. I think this chapter hints that God is near. The very fact that God is never named in Esther makes me think of him all the more. Is that how it works for you? Like when I'm reading Esther, as soon as somebody told me God is never named, then I'm like looking for him all over the place, right? Because this is in the Bible. The Bible is about God. So if there's a story about God that doesn't talk about God, it's almost like in the whisper, he yells. And this story is about evil. Raw evil. Well, how do we know it's evil? Do we know there's such a thing as evil? What makes something evil? It's evil over against righteousness, right? It's evil because there's such a thing as holiness, of goodness. The reason why these words are so shocking is because of God. Destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Where is God when great evil happens? Well, the rest of the Bible tells us he's near. None of this evil takes him by surprise. In fact, he may even have a plan for it. This world is not spiraling out of control. God is not absent. He's just telling a story with some awful things in it. some bewildering things, but we know they're not outside of his control. How do we know this from chapter 3? Well, here's one of the hints. In verse 7, when they cast the pur, that is the lot, what does every Hebrew child who has memorized the Proverbs of Solomon know about the lot? Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. There's no such thing as coincidence. We said that last week. Well, there's also no such thing as chance. For all of our intents and purposes, the lot is random. Nobody knows how this is going to come up. But there's no such thing as luck. We don't understand all of it, but God controls the twists and turns of our story. He may not be named in Esther 3:7, but we know that every decision of the lot is somehow from the Lord. He's near. Second, I think that Esther chapter 3 hints that there are worse things than being hated. Now, I wouldn't want to be in Mordecai's shoes. Do you want to be Mordecai? But there are shoes in chapter 3 that I would want to be in less. I'd hate to be in Xerxes' shoes. And I'd really hate to be in Haman's. Chapter 3 presents these two guys as examples of how not to live. Negative examples. Xerxes is clueless, careless, and callous. He's irresponsible with his power and authority. He's greedy and thoughtless about the people under his authority. He is selfish and unjust. I would rather be Mordecai than Xerxes, even if that means being bewildered, even if it means being killed. And Haman. Haman is malicious. He's full of bitterness and pettiness. He is sly and slanderous. He is out for revenge. He's on a power trip. He is full of diabolical rage. I'd rather be Mordecai than Haman, even if I didn't know how the rest of this story goes, drinking it up while the world burns. There are worse things than being hated. Followers of Jesus Christ are supposed to be different from the world. We, like the Jews, are dispersed and scattered all over the world. We live in the world, but we're not supposed to be of it. We live among the Hamans of this world, but we're not supposed to become like them. Not even so that they like us. There are worse things than being hated. There are even worse things than being killed. And last hint of hope from chapter 3, and this will take us to the table. I think that Esther chapter 3 hints that God will save his people. He has before, right? Here's one last hint from chapter 3. In verse 12, did you notice what day it was when the royal secretaries wrote out the order to excommunicate the Jews? Of course you didn't. Neither did I. We don't know what is the 13th day of the first month. But every single Jew did. That was the day before Passover. That was Passover Eve. The 14th day of the first month, Exodus chapter 12, that's the day they're supposed to have Passover. It was April 18th that year of 474 BC. Now, on one level, it's terrible that they're being threatened again on the very day that they're supposed to celebrate their great rescue. But I'll bet that when they saw the order come across from King Xerxes, and that was the date at the top of the order, there were a lot of Jewish heads nodding at each other from across the room. He rescued us before. He can do it again. And more than that, God has promised to send them a Messiah to save them once and for all. And if God let Haman kill all of the Jews, the Messiah would never come. And you and I would never be saved. Yet here we are at his table again. So I don't think we have to stay bewildered. Amen.